From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Akwan. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunathchi, Shawa, Toexik Nusum, Salama. Thank you for joining the conversation. You can also join us via our live stream on YouTube at ktoo.org/JPMLive or on KTOO's Instagram and Facebook pages. Conversations for this Thursday, October 9th, the Juno World Affairs Council previews their fall forum. It's called Unratified, the International Law of the Sea Treaties and Their Potential for Protecting Arctic Resources and Cultures. It's happening this Friday, October 10th and Saturday, October 11th. Out at UAS this Friday, it's Researching the Mendenhall Outburst Flood 2025 and Beyond, which is part of the Fall Evening at Egan series. We dive in to find out what they found out. And Jane Ginter is here to share about the Chopathon out at Eagle River United Methodist Camp this Saturday. All that coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Hi, this is Coach Razor with JDHS Softball, and this is a Juno Afternoon Calendar Delight. Crimson Bear softball team is bringing back the Pumpkin Patch event. The Pumpkin Patch will be on Saturday, October 11th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Adair Kennedy Field Complex. Bring your family to the Pumpkin Patch and pick out your perfect pumpkins. Pumpkins will be priced from $15 to $25 each. There will also be games for the kids, face painting, sweet treats with hot drinks, cotton candy, and a family picture area. You can find out more information on our JDHS softball Facebook page or by calling or texting 907-957-1311. Thank you, have a great fall, and we hope to see you at the Pumpkin Patch.
Yeah, it's a little Juno Afternoon Calendar Delight. If you'd like to submit a calendar delight, just email us at junoafternoon@ktoo.org. Listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. You can even throw a chat in there, and I might be able to see it, which would be kind of cool. This Friday and Saturday, October 10th and 11th, the Juno World Affairs Council is sponsoring their annual fall forum. This year's topic, Unratified, the International Law of the Sea Treaties and Their Potential for Protecting Arctic Resources and Cultures. With a bevy of guest speakers and panel discussions on tap, it's a full schedule covering a range of topics on this subject. Looking at what it is, what's happening, and the future. For the full schedule, you can head over to jwac.org. And here to help us break it down even further is Bruce Patello and Jim Baldwin. Gunathchi, gentlemen. Good afternoon. Wasiati, Bruce. How are you today?
Wonderful. Glad to be here, Boss.
Excellent. Welcome back to the show. And Jim, Gunathchi, Wasiati, how are you?
Equally glad.
Equally glad. I know you start tomorrow around 1 o'clock, so you are in the throes of final preparations and doing all the things. And, of course, you do that right downstairs here at KTOO, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll be in Studio 1 and looking to see a full Juno audience. Many of your listeners may not be aware that we also record these events so that they can be rebroadcast later on 360 North, and as well as on our YouTube page, so that people have a chance to get the program not only live but in studio, but also to be able to access it around the state.
So yeah, if you missed something or if you wanted to rehear something that maybe you attended and you're like, what was that I missed? I want to make sure I know what it was. You can always find that on YouTube and on 360 TV, which is kind of cool. That's excellent. But of course, you can come on down. It's free, right, Bruce, to come to the forum?
It is free.
The fall forum is totally free. And I was looking at this schedule, and this is intense. This is like, this is really packed full.
Yeah, well, I would say this is a good graduate-level course in one weekend.
In one weekend, you can get it all done. So tell us what the Juneau World Affairs Council Fall Forum is all about. I know you have speakers that you do throughout the year, but then why do the Fall Forum, Jim?
Well, we kind of have focused on two areas. One is the United Nations Law of the Sea Treaty, and how it's affecting a movement that we have now to extend our outer continental shelf in the Arctic. And when we proposed to do that, an objection was raised by Russia that we could not do that because we were not a party to the UN Law of the Sea Treaty. And this treaty was adopted in 1983 and went into effect in 1995, and the United States did never ratified it. And our U.S. Constitution requires that treaties must be ratified by a two-thirds vote of the Senate. Mm. And that has never been done. There were questions when it was first presented to the Senate about seabed mining and issues like that that have never really been completely resolved. And so the treaty remains unratified, but the United States has been moving along, following the process set out in the treaty. So what we've now that the state of Alaska wants to extend its continental shelf for various reasons, a lot of other countries are doing this worldwide. It's come up again. President Putin of the Russia objected to our extended continental shelf actions. And so that's where we are wanting to examine that and see how it can go forward, what the issues are. The other part that we're going to examine is the what's known as the High Seas Treaty, which is the BBNJ Treaty, which it deals with preserving biodiversity in areas that are not subject to national jurisdiction. So it's also known as the High Seas Treaty because it deals with waters that are not a part of any nation. And so that treaty is has just recently received a number of ratifications necessary for it to become international law. Again, the United States has not ratified that treaty as yet. There's still time to do that. And that treaty, I think, will be very important for indigenous people around the globe because they're actually given a place at the table on the decision-making that happens under that treaty. It's a very complicated treaty, and we're trying to bring in people who can help us understand what's going to happen now that it's been implemented.
I can see why this is over 2 days as opposed to one evening chat, right?
Right.
It's a big topic, and we're talking about two different things. We've got the Law of the Seas Treaty and the High Seas Treaty, two different things. Both haven't been ratified, I'm understanding, by
that's
the United
right.
States. Okay, so that's sort of the examination and why this is the Fall Forum and the topic. And why did you choose to do it now? Why is this the topic for now?
Well, we had tried to do this somewhat earlier.
Okay.
I think the timing is right now as we go into our political season here in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Our senator has been engaged in this. Our U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski has been engaged in this issue quite deeply, and we're hoping that she'll continue with that. So
yeah.
I think that's kind of my thinking on the timing. I don't know about you, Bruce.
There's been a lot more emphasis here, particularly in the last couple of years, over deep sea mining.
Mm.
And not to mention an issue which has long been out there, which is the idea of deep sea oil drilling. The other aspect that is increasingly coming to the fore is the look at international cargo traffic along the northern routes paralleling Russia or the Northwest Passage. That is, the Arctic is opening up. Ships are going to be using that route, which they're beginning to, it means about one-third of the sailing time that is normally required to sail between Europe and Asia could be cut off, which in turn turns the Bering Strait, frankly, into a major freeway.
Right, okay. And you mentioned Senator Murkowski, who you do have on the schedule tomorrow. We're talking about the JWAC Fall Forum here on Juno Afternoon. It begins tomorrow around 1 o'clock, I believe.
Exactly at 1.
And there's a bunch of sessions tomorrow. And you have a conversation with Senator Lisa Murkowski, a leader in bipartisan efforts urging the U.S. Senate to ratify the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. That's going to be from 5 to 5:30.
Yes, and I should point out, she will not be here in person. She will
be zooming in,
yeah.
As it were. But it's still good to have that conversation, people, and you are going to have – is somebody going to moderate that panel? How does that work?
I will be introducing her, and to the extent that we have any kind of exchange,
yeah,
I'll be moderating that.
Okay, that's great. So let's talk a little bit about the schedule. You have a fantastic lineup of guest speakers. I figured maybe you would want to highlight some of them and some of the sessions that people might want to attend. You don't have to go to the whole thing, by the way. If you want to pop in and pop out, I'm sure that's okay.
Absolutely welcome to do that. We realize that people have busy schedules, particularly this weekend. This is a typical fall weekend in Juneau. Many things going on.
There's so much going on, but you can go to jwac.org. I have it up here on the stream right now, but you can see the whole schedule available there. We're going to highlight a few things here, but you can see the whole schedule there and plan it out. It basically goes from 1 o'clock until the early evening tomorrow, and then it goes on Saturday morning up through the afternoon. So there's just various different times and events that people can decide to attend. But do you guys want to highlight a couple of the guest speakers and topics that you think that people should definitely, I mean, everybody should attend all of them, I guess, but I'm just curious if there's ones that we don't have time to highlight every single one, but I'm just curious if there's, if you want to talk about some of the guest speakers and what they'll be talking on.
I would highlight for tomorrow's program, first Steve White, the executive director of Marine Exchange of Alaska, who will be doing a visual on the kinds of activities that are happening right now off the coast of Alaska. It really provides the geographic framework for all the discussions that are going to take place. Jim Nafziger, professor of law at Willamette, will provide the basic 101 of what the UN Convention on Law of the Sea is about.
Mm.
Again, all the programs I think are fantastic. Jim alluded to the discussion about the outer continental shelf, and we have an Alaska expert from Anchorage, Dr. Betsy Baker, who will be talking about that.
Mm.
Aside from Senator Murkowski, in the evening we have two panels, one that I think will be both are very interesting, but one focusing on the national security implications of both the Law of the Sea Treaty and the High Seas Treaty, and where Alaska fits into that. And finally, discussion of what is the benefit, if any, to Alaska by ratification, or on the other hand, what the detriment is to Alaska by our continued failure to ratify.
I love the title of that last session called Chasing the Mirage. Does the U.S. benefit from United Nations Convention of the Law on the Law of the Sea? And what is its relevance to the Arctic, right? So that's going to be, that's an interesting discussion right there.
Yeah, I'll let Jim talk about Saturday's program.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim, take us away.
Yeah, well, Saturday we focus on the High Seas Treaty, the BBNJ. Liz Curran is with the Pew Memorial Trust, and she, shepherded the treaty as it was going through its drafting process, and so it was very... has very close association with it and knowledge of how that treaty was developed. And then we have Dr. Dali Sambo-Duro, who was the former head of the Inupiat Conference, the ICC, Circumpolar Conference. Yeah, Inupiat Circumpolar Conference. She was a academic at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and also is part of many other international groups, as well as the Arctic Council. And she will have, I think, very interesting things to say about how the BBNJ treaty came about and what it's intended to do. Mm. It's a very new and far-reaching type treaty, and it's going to take some time for it to work its way into effect. It was just received its 60 approvals by member countries of the United Nations, and it will not go in effect until January of 2025.
Mm, interesting. Yeah, wow. What's the...
26.
Yeah. 26, yeah, 26. Yeah, sorry, yeah, right.
So I know you all aren't the experts necessarily, but what's the holdup on the ratification of these treaties?
I think a lot of it has been an historic resistance by many members of the Senate to what they see as a relinquishment of national sovereignty by the U.S., by ratification of anything under the umbrella of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. So that has been a consistent problem, not only with these treaties, but with others. I think, and we have a speaker who will be addressing this from the Heritage Foundation, Stephen Groves, whose view is there's no reason for the U.S. to have to ratify because we generally follow the law anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is another perspective that will be offered.
I see. Okay. And then the final one will happen at 1:30. It's the final panel discussion, and it says, where do we go from here? Which will be really interesting after people have gotten a chance to sort of learn everything that's going on and attend some of these panel discussions or topics or discussions, speakers talking about the things, which is going to be really interesting. So is there other things that we need to know about this? I know we mentioned that it's no cost, which is part of JWAC's mission, right, is to provide these talks and forums at no cost to the public, which is fantastic. Do I have to sign up or do I just show up?
Just show up.
Just show up.
Yeah, we'll make sure that there's a chair for you.
There's a chair for you. I love that. We'll hold the seat for you. It's like the old Tom Baudet. We have a chair for you.
Yes.
Instead of the
we'll
light,
the
it's
light
a chair.
On for you, yes.
Yeah, we'll have a chair for you. That's a good one. I like that. That'd be a good slogan for JWAC. We'll hold the chair
like
for you.
We like to think that our slogan, bringing the world to Juneau, probably has a little better ring to it. But.
That's true. You do have that wonderful slogan. And is there obviously there's breaks, times for dinner. Is there a lunch or anything? Anything I need to know about? Or do I bring a lunch? Do I bring a bag? What do I do? Do I bring a bag, brown bag?
Well, we'll assume that most people who are showing up will have eaten before they arrive. We're not encouraging people to bring any refreshments into the studio.
Gotcha. Okay.
And that's consistent, obviously, with the sign on the door.
Okay.
I will mention, quite apart from the forum, we have a couple other events coming up that may be of note. They're a little farther off. We have the former U.S. ambassador to Kuwait and Iraq having served up through 2024. Ambassador Romanowski, who will be addressing the Juneau World Affairs Council on December 12th, and giving her perspective on the developments in the Middle East. We will be having our annual, and it's the only event where we charge our fundraiser, which is WorldQuest. The trivia game, along with a great silent auction and a good dinner, on December 31st at Centennial. January 31st.
I was going to say, not New Year's Eve, right? Yeah, it comes in January, yeah.
January 31st. Yeah. Again, people can see some of our other programming that we're listing out again at jwac.org.
Absolutely. And it's the Fall Forum. It's happening from the Juneau World Affairs Council. It's unratified, the International Law of the Sea treaties and their potential for protecting Arctic resources and cultures. Bruce Botello, Jim Baldwin, thank you so much, Gunathcheesh, for coming in and telling us a little all about it.
Thank you.
Yeah, and of course, reminder, you can also, if you can't make it to the sessions this weekend, they will be recorded and broadcast on 360 TV as well as on JWAC's YouTube page. Really appreciate you gentlemen coming in today.
Thank you.
Gunathcheesh. This is Juneau Afternoon on KTOO. Support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Keishi Bessie Cooley. And the word this week is Keich.
Keich.
That means dog. And here's a sentence. The dog is the man's best friend. Let's hear it again.
Keich.
Gunathcheesh Tochune Lance Twitchell, Goldbelt Heritage Foundation and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Keishi Bessie Cooley is Kokhetan and a child of a Yenyedi man. She is from Daisleen, Teslin, and grew up spending time in Teslin and around Teslin Lake. She earned a master's degree in Indigenous Languages and Linguistics from Simon Fraser University and interviewed many speakers for the Hashagun language series. She is currently translating projects for the Children of the Taku Society.
Tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
From the KTOO newsroom, I'm Mike Lane. Today is Thursday, October 9th. On this day in 1914, an 8-mile-per-hour speed limit was put into effect in Juneau, keeping in mind that the automobile was a relatively new invention at the time. Reportedly, the first automobile seen by the residents of Juneau was the Abbott Detroit Bulldog, driven by Charles Percival during his cross-continental durability run in 1911. Percival planned to offload the Bulldog in Juneau for a spin around town while traveling south from Skagway, but the steamship schedule didn't allow time for that. Instead, people could only admire the Bulldog while it sat on the city of Seattle's forward deck. That's a look back at this day in 1914.
This is Juneau Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. This Friday's Evening at Egan Lecture Series features UAS researchers Jason Amundsen and Aaron Hood, who will be discussing how the Mendenhall Glacier flooding has evolved and how they are working with others to determine how glacier outburst floods will evolve in the future at Mendenhall Glacier and beyond, right across Alaska. So I'm pleased to welcome to the studio now Jason Amundsen. Gunathcheesh, Jason. Good day.
Gunathcheesh.
And Aaron Hood. Gunathcheesh, Wasiti. How are you today, buddy?
Good. Great to be here.
Okay. Good to have you back. And I also have in the studio with me Dean of Arts and Sciences, Karen Zalkaitis. Gunathcheesh.
Gunathcheesh. Hey.
Nice to see you. And so, Karen, let's start with you. Just for those who may not be inducted into the UAS Evening at Egan Lecture Series, what is that thing?
Yeah, so Arts and Sciences hosts Evening at Egan, and we're so excited to host these events. They're really meant to be conversations with our community. We love to host them. For me, I really love when people come in person. Of course, they can also join the Zoom webinars that we set up if they can't be there in person and they have to come online. But I really hope that people show up in person. We've got coffee and cookies.
The cookies is always a selling point.
They really are.
They should be shaped like a river. You could have like a river, but then it's like overflowing with the icing coming off the top.
You know, Boston, don't put that kind of pressure on me. I don't know that I need that. But I will say that last time the cookies were, for our last lecture, the cookies were like spectacularly delicious. They cleaned me out of cookies.
Karen.
What, Boston?
You make cupcakes, and when you open the cupcake up, it just floods out. It's like blue icing.
I rarely say no to people, but I'm just going to say no to you right now, Boston. That's not happening.
I know you're thinking about it now. You're thinking about it. Okay, and these are – the schedule varies, right?
They're always at 7 o'clock.
They're at 7, but the days vary,
that
right?
That is right.
In terms of they're always on a Friday.
Yes.
But the weeks that they happen might vary. And where do we find the schedule then for that?
If you just Google Evening at Egan, UA. It is going to pop up for you. You're going to see our website and all of the dates that are upcoming. This one is this Friday, like tomorrow. At 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be in the Egan Lecture Hall. And we want you to come. They're always free.
Yeah, that's good. Free is good.
Free is always good. But, yeah. You know, they're great conversations. So there's usually – the format is generally – somebody gives a talk, and then afterwards there's always time for conversation and questions. And I think that's my favorite part, is that our audience gets a chance to, chat with our speakers.
Absolutely. Well, we've got the speakers here to give us a little preview.
We do.
And I have some questions for you all, because I'm really curious. This affects everyone in town, even if you don't live in that area, right? Because it is on our brains. We have friends and neighbors who live there. And it's happened, it seems like over the last few years, everyone's more aware, yes, because it's been happening and they've been growing, right? Which is really kind of interesting. And I know, Aaron, you've done some different talks over the last couple years. You worked with Anna Canny, our former climate reporter, to do some stuff and some talks out in the community. And so it's really curious to see, like, now that it's been like many more years and the research is probably digging in a little bit, like, what you've learned. Right. So I'm curious let's start with overall, Aaron, sort of what have we learned? Is it hard to do an overall, or can we just say, like, do we know like some of the big ticket items that we know about this flooding?
No, I'll list a few and then I'm sure Jason can add on to this. But I think we have a very good understanding of how the basin, the shape and the sort of extent of the basin are changing over time. And that obviously has really important implications for the flood, because it determines how much water the basin can hold. We also understand a lot better how far down the basin can drain. And obviously we saw a big shift in 2023 where it used to drain partway. And then it started draining much more completely. And that's when we saw this big jump in terms of the flood magnitude. So we'll talk some about that. And then I think Jason could probably speak to aspects of that, and then also look into the future.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think you mostly summarized what I was going to say, that we have a much better understanding of the volume. There's still, looking at floods from one year to the next, there's definitely things we don't understand, like why there's variability from one year to the next. Mm-hmm. I think we're starting to get a handle on some of that related to, like, this year the flood coincided with a major rainstorm, and we think that affected the flood dynamics a little bit.
Yeah, because it was raining a lot. That was one that was interesting, because the idea that it seemed to peak earlier than we had predicted. Was that right? It was about a day early. Was that due to that rain?
Well, it's a couple of things. One, because of the rain and the clouds, it was so hard to know what was going on up in the basin. We have cameras up there. We have a LIDAR that's pointing at the basin and tells us, is the basin filling up or is it draining? And we just weren't getting any data for a while. So it was really hard to determine when the flood started. And it turns out the beginning of the flood is a really slow process. What you see in town is like, oh, the water came up really fast, but actually it takes like 12, 24 hours before it really starts to pick up. And so we didn't know when the beginning of the flood was. So that was part of it. And then the other part was just that the flood, the it released a little bit faster this year. So actually the volume of water that was involved in the flood was really similar to the year before, but it released a little bit faster, and then it coincided with that rainstorm as well, which made the water levels rise higher than it had in 24.
How fast did the water rush out?
I don't know the numbers, but...
Yeah, it's hard to know the numbers. I mean, it was increasing well over maybe several thousand cubic feet per second per hour. In other words, the discharge, the amount of water in the river was increasing very rapidly, more rapidly than we've seen in the past, certainly. We're going to show some data about that tomorrow. We have some videos. We have some cool 3D models. We have a lot of like drone products. And really, we're hoping to just give people some insight into what we're looking at when we're trying to understand what's going on up there and the kind of information that we've been able to collect and how that's going to help us, you know, figure out sort of what's going on now and how we can forecast it better now, but also looking a little into the future as
well. Because this year it seemed, even though we know that rain helped maybe get it to a little bit earlier than had been predicted, but it seemed like the predictions of when it's going to happen are getting really close. And so is that, how does that data collection, what are you doing to make that prediction so accurate? What's the data that you're collecting or what's giving you that information?
Yeah, I mean, basically we have a catalog of floods now for whatever, 14, 15 years. Some floods are small, some are big. But the floods themselves look very similar from year to year, just the scale gets changed. Mm. And so by knowing how much water is in the basin, we can then scale those previous floods to get the right shape of the hydrograph. And then we put that on top of the, you know, the existing hydrograph that's being recorded. And so that, yeah, it seems to work really well.
Yeah, it's getting eerily accurate, right? I mean, it's sort of funny because we always make fun of like the weatherman, right? It's like, you don't know the actual weather, but they're doing the best they can. But you all seem to be getting almost pinpoint accurate, right? Which I think is kind of crazy. Yeah. Can we mention the second release, the smaller flood we had in September? Why did those happen?
Well, I mean, the basic issue is that after the ice is very thick, there's an ice dam, the Mendenhall Glacier, which is impounding the water in the basin. When the water forces its way under and creates a conduit where it all drains out, because the ice is so thick there, the overburden or the pressure closes the conduit up. And so when the conduit closes, it can actually restart, the filling can restart very soon after the drainage ends. And that's what we saw both last year and this year. If you know, there's a lot of people who watch those cameras up there and you look at it and you can see, oh, wow, the water level is going up again. And so it's not like a system where it necessarily stays open. We actually think that it's kind of open right now because there's water flowing into it and it's not filling. But at that time after the flood in summer, it seemed to have closed back up relatively quickly. And so it started refilling.
I see.
But it's later in the year, so the filling rates are lower. And, you know, we were fairly certain couldn't get to the point of being full again because there just wasn't enough time to redo, you know, essentially all the filling that we had over the summer. You'd have to redo that.
I see. And Jason, after all the study over these years, was there anything that was surprising this year that you weren't expecting?
I'm not sure about surprising. Maybe just that it was, I guess what I've learned over these last 15 years or so is that we shouldn't be surprised. Like it's just so much variability from one year to the next, both in terms of the magnitude. We've had one year where it looked like there was going to be a big flood, and then about halfway through it stopped draining, and then a couple days later it started again. So it just seems like every year is a little different, and so maybe I've learned to not be surprised anymore. If there was anything, though, I guess it was just that it was how quickly it released this year compared to 24. So a very, very similar volume of water, but for some reason it released faster.
Okay. And then when we we know we've seen the charts. I know we had like a 24-hour stream going here at KTOO, and we had the graph with the height, you know, and we know, and people are now overlaying the height maps on when they're looking at buying a home in the valley, and where would 16 feet reach, and where would 17 feet reach, where would all this happen? So I'm curious about how high the water reaches in the river, because we know that there's at the lake we measure it, right?
Yeah.
But is there a better metric to understand the height that's happening in the actual river?
Well, I mean, I think those inundation maps do a very nice job of translating that, right? Because what they directly translate is what is the height in the lake to the height at your house when you plot, like if you go to the flood dashboard. You can see that. You can move the cursor around and see, okay, if it's 17 feet in the lake, it's going to be 4 feet at this address here. Basically, the lake level is correlated with the amount of water in the river corridor. And so you could use either metric, but people seem to relate better to lake level. That's something that everyone sort of has in their mind. So we've been trying to stick with that. But you could convert it into discharge in the river. Either way, the inundation maps are the way to translate the amount of water coming out into the lake and how that will move over the landscape, either with or without the HESCO barriers.
I feel like it makes sense because people, if you have too many numbers, that would confuse people, right? So it's better to say, okay, this is what it looks like if you get to 18 feet or, you
exactly.
know, whatever it would be. So for the talk tomorrow night, Friday, we're talking about Evening at Egan here on Juno Afternoon with Jason Amundsen and Aaron Hood from UAS. They're going to be talking about what they've learned about the Mendenhall Glacier flooding and how things might evolve in the future, not just for here, but for all of Alaska. So what are some of the takeaways that you think might be helpful for us in the future? I know you're going to talk about it tomorrow, but just give us a little tease.
Yeah, well, I guess we're going to mostly focus on Mendenhall, but you know, part of the work we're starting to do with some of our colleagues is also the sort of stuff that if someone had done 50 years ago in Juneau, they might have looked at Mendenhall Glacier and said, oh, you should be worried. There's a basin there that could become a hazard in the future. And so one of the things we want to start doing is to take our knowledge here from Mendenhall and translating it to other glaciers around Alaska and trying to identify are there other places that could become hazards in the future.
Ah, that's pretty smart, because then maybe they don't develop as much things around there in terms of, you know, all the folks who are affected out in the valley, right? I mean, that makes sense. I mean, it's hard to tell everybody to move, right? You can't just do that, but because it's such a sort of solid place that people are now. But how do we think, do we know anything about next year yet? Like in terms of are we already preparing for a larger number in terms of what that lake level will be, that one number that we do sort of monitor?
I would say we're working through the numbers. So with our drone surveys that we're doing, we're trying to figure out what is the volume of the basin and how is that changing over time. And so we know that it's gotten bigger over the last 5 years, the basin has. I don't know yet if we can exactly say how much it's going to change from this year to the next, but that's something we're working on.
So the basin getting larger is what's making the lake level get higher each year. So
that's
yeah,
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So and it's basically, you know, the glacier is thinning, which would make you think that the basin should get smaller over time. But there's also a lot of icebergs up there, and as those melt away, that creates storage capacity or volume.
Ah.
And so it's kind of a competition between a couple of different things.
Okay, now the hard question, is there anything that we can do, like a regular old Joe like me, is there anything that I can do? What do I do?
I think, well, one thing, and I'm just going to make a plug, so we developed the dashboard, which I think many people are familiar with, the JunoFlood.com, to help people make decisions. But what we need now is feedback on the dashboard, right? And so after the Evening at Egan this Sunday, we're actually going to have a meeting in the Valley Library. And so I'll do a plug for this at Evening at Egan. But what we want people to come out and do is tell us, does this dashboard work for what you need? Or are there ways that we could modify it that would make it better to help you make decisions about your property and what you're going to do? And so I think that's really the thing that, you know, people can be prepared and have as much knowledge as they can. That's the way that we're all going to be safer. And so our hope in developing that dashboard was to give people the kind of information they need to make decisions. But we also need people who are using it to come back to us and say, this part works for us, but could you add information about this? Or, you know, what other functionalities could we add to it that might help people in the community to help themselves?
Well, Gunnath Cheese, for all the work that you do and all the research that you continue to do to help make Juneau a safer place on the Mendenhall Glacier outburst flooding. It's tomorrow's Friday evening at Egan, and it is featuring Jason Amundson and Aaron Hood. That will start at 7 o'clock tomorrow. If you can't make it out to UAS, it's in the lecture hall, but if you can't make it out, it will be recorded. But it's always better to show up in person. And finally, Karen, is there anything else happening at UAS that we need to alert the people to?
Yeah, I think I just want to tease a couple of the future evening at Egan's. On Friday, October 24th, we're going to do Living on the Edge, the Ecology of Mountain Goats and Avalanches. Aaron was also involved in that research with Dr. Kevin White. It's going to be a really cool talk about, I think, the dangers that our poor mountain goats are in when they, it's a trade-off. It's a very perilous trade-off when they go up into the mountains and have to deal with these snow avalanches. And next will be Arctic Ecosystems in a Warming World with Dr. Logan Berner on Friday, November 14th, talking about climate change in the Arctic. It's a really and Logan Berner is an awesome speaker. He's really engaging, and I think you're going to love that. And lastly, we're getting the band back together with me, Ernestine Hayes, Lily Hope, and Emily Wall. And that one we all know is called Winter Fire Showcase. And that one is going to be Friday, December 13th for our final evening at Egan for that creative showcase.
I love that. And is there another event out at UAS that we want to alert folks to?
We do. Thank you for teeing that up for me, Boston. I really appreciate it. We have a really cool UAS open house on Saturday, October 25th. That's from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. We're really targeting high school students. We want you all to come out and learn how to apply to a degree program, sign up for classes. You can meet with financial aid staff. You can learn how to pay for college. Also, there's a really cool drawing for tuition waiver. It's open to everyone, but high school students are especially encouraged to attend. Check-in starts at 11 a.m. in Egan Library.
And you can find out more at uas.alaska.edu.
You sure can.
And I just saw a press release that said in-state tuition starting for everybody in 2026.
Yeah,
that's pretty amazing.
Out-of-state students, yeah. Everyone. Everybody's going to get in-state tuition.
And study here at UAS. Let your friends know. Well, thank you so much, Gunnath Cheese, for being here today, y'all. I really appreciate it. Break a leg tomorrow with the Evening at Egan Lecture Series. This is Juneau Afternoon on KTOO. Let's take a listen to this week's Our Living Lands from Native Voice One.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Deb Holland, a member of the Pueblo of Laguna, was the first Indigenous U.S. Secretary of the Interior. Now she's running for governor of New Mexico. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke with her about the challenges and opportunities facing tribes, including climate change and political headwinds.
What are some of the environmental accomplishments you are proud of from your time leading the Department of Interior?
I mean, there's many, right? We had some really wonderful tribally led conservation efforts in Nevada, in Utah, in New Mexico. And we were very proud of the work we did with the Dorshak Fish Hatchery too in Idaho. So we really felt like tribes should have a seat at the table, and we wanted to make sure that they had a voice in bringing forward the environmental stewardship opportunities that they wanted to. Another thing is we're very proud of the 400 co-stewardship agreements that we signed with tribes. And that was really a win-win situation for both the Department of the Interior and for the tribes.
And what were some of the challenges that you faced or areas where you wish you could have, you know, maybe done a little bit more?
There's always more you can absolutely do. When I first got sworn in to my office at the department, four years seemed like a really long time. And, you know, by the end, we were really, everybody, it was all hands on deck trying to move things forward. I mean, I feel like it's hard for me to regret. We really did accomplish a lot, but there's always more you can do, right? Climate change isn't taking a break on our planet. And so we, you know, it's almost like we have to step up exponentially in order to fight climate change. I wish we could have done more transmission lines or done more clean energy. I wish wish we could have conserved more land because, you know, we think about the 30 by 30 and, you know, we still have to strive toward that goal. I'm going to keep moving forward and doing everything I can for our environment because we have an obligation to future generations.
And you're running for governor of New Mexico, which has, you know, a unique, diverse environmental landscape. As governor, what are the ways you would hope to, you know, work with tribal nations to deal with climate change's impacts?
Absolutely. Well, you know, tribes always do what they do best, and that's conserve land. I mean, there are some conservation efforts right here in New Mexico that I absolutely still support. And I know that tribes will, you know, they'll bring those forward and however I can help. Because look, New Mexico needs more industry and we need more, people need jobs. They need good paying jobs with benefits. We have a really wonderful outdoor economy and I just feel like it can always be better. And the only way we have a quality outdoor economy is if we are conserving our landscapes, that we have, there's water in the river, there's, you know, our trails are pristine. I think the outdoor economy is, it brings in billions of dollars across New Mexico and across our country. So it's worth it. It's absolutely worth it to make sure we're striving for, you know, to preserve our landscapes.
And you worked with indigenous communities at the tribal, state, and federal levels. How can tribes and indigenous people navigate these layers of authority to protect their land and culture?
The era of government telling tribes what they need to do or what they should do should absolutely be over. And the tribes themselves should be stepping up to say, this is what we want to do. And we would love to have the governments as partners. And so if I'm the next governor of New Mexico, I absolutely want to be partners with the tribes here. What, you know, how can the state be a good partner? How can we invest in infrastructure and make sure that we're paying attention to the things that the tribes want to do for themselves?
And today, tribes are dealing with a very different federal government than the one that you were a part of. What do you think the next few years looks like for tribal communities?
Right. Well, I think that, first of all, governors will be the first line of defense against the worst policies coming out of this administration. We need to hold the federal government's feet to the fire when it comes to the funding that they're obligated to give to states. And so I think it will be up to every elected official to ensure that the federal government lives up to its trust and treaty obligations to tribes here in New Mexico, absolutely, and across the country.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Hanson Gress, Ka eat with the Shu Yi, where Kashuk are ye tin. Jin kat ka ke jin talk anachaya ha anikach, gunish cheese.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO, dedicated to Carolyn Hobbs Peterson. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. I am joined in the studio now by Jane Ginter, here to share about the Chopathon happening this Saturday from 9 to 2 out at Eagle River United Methodist Camp, mile 28, out the road. Gunith Chi, Sha'igidi, thank you so much, Jane, for coming in. Wasiyati, how are you today?
I'm doing great.
Excellent. Well, it's nice to see you. It was nice to catch up with you. I've worked with both, your son and your daughter in
great.
Various different capacities over the years, and so it's a pleasure to see you again. And know that they're all doing well.
They are.
That's good. So we're going to talk a little bit about not only what this Chopathon, and in my brain earlier today, Jane, I was calling it the Chompathon.
But wow, it's not. That sounds good.
That's a different kind of thing. Maybe that's a barbecue.
Right.
You could also have out there. But tell us a little bit about the Chopathon that's happening this Saturday.
Well, we have a Chopathon every fall where we gather volunteers to come help us prepare firewood for the winter. So we've got a whole bunch of rounds, and we've got rounds of wood, and we've got trees, and we've got all sorts of splitters and all sorts of chainsaws and all sorts of people to help us cut up that wood so that we can have fires in the fireplace out at the lodge and also have fires in the outdoor fireplace. So we need a lot of workers to come help us chop up this wood.
Yeah, I've got one picture up here for those who are watching the live stream. People in action doing the various different things with those big pieces and getting them down in terms of thing we might be able to burn in a fireplace.
That's right.
Okay, and so what can people expect? Like I saw there's something, there's like some hydraulic log splitters.
We have a lot of equipment out there.
Yeah.
And so if people have any experience with chainsaws or sharpening chainsaws or working with log splitters, we'd be glad to have you. But if you don't have that kind of experience, we can certainly use you. We need people to stack the wood once we cut it up. We have two different sections in our woodshed. One is for this year, so that's the stuff that's been drying out for a year. And then we've got another section called next year, and that's the one we're trying to fill up right now. So we can use people that can help stack wood. And then if you really don't want to have anything to do with wood, we have lots of other chores to do around camp. So we're going to be having a burn pit to burn a lot of excess things that we need to burn. And so if we could use a couple people that could help us monitor the fire there in the burn pit, and that's kind of a fun thing to do too. We have all sorts of other jobs around camp, just kind of tidying up and cleaning up around camp. So we'll find something for you to do.
Yeah, and I also saw that there was kitchen volunteers needed.
Yeah.
Because there is going to be some lunch. So
right,
people,
right. We have folks from the Polaris House. They're actually going to be spending the night out there.
Okay.
And they're going to be helping with lunch. But if anybody else would like to help with lunch, we can do that as well.
Lots of jobs available.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so get your volunteer hours in out at Eagle River United Methodist Camp for the Chop-a-thon. It starts at 9 a.m., and people don't have to register anything.
They just show up, right? They come up whenever they can. And
okay.
Usually it's going to be probably 3 hours of pretty hard work if you're going to be working with the wood. So we'd recommend that you bring gloves and that you bring ear protection to protect from the chainsaws. And it's going to be a dirty job if you're out there wrangling these logs, so wear appropriate clothing and boots.
Okay.
But as a benefit for helping with a chop-a-thon, we'll give you a coupon for half off use of a cabin during the off-season time. So you can come and make use of the camp and come stay in a cabin with your family, and that should be a lot of fun for you.
That's fantastic. What a great benefit for just helping out for a few hours. That's kind of nice. So what else is going on at the camp? I know there's other things coming up and things that you want to mention.
Well, we have new camp managers there. They arrived in May. Kevin and Nicola Voss, and they are very, very enthusiastic and very happy about being at a camp. They're just working really hard. And this last summer, we had a mission group come from a Methodist church in Michigan. They brought 19 workers, and they worked for about 10 days straight, and they replaced all the flooring in our lodge. If you come in and take a look at the lodge now, you'll notice that it really looks great. They also installed a lot of heat pumps, and this is the third year in a row that they've come, and they've already got 40 people lined up to come next summer. Our big project next summer is to build a pole barn. And this is kind of like an open warehouse kind of barn. Mm. And then we are going to have a closed section too. And we have had a sawmill out there the last couple of weeks where we have been sawing boards for this pole barn. And it is just the most amazing thing to watch. They've had the sawmill set up there and they just cut all these boards. And now we've got all the boards lined up and waiting to get cured over the winter, and then we'll start up next summer building this pole barn. So we have lots of cabins, and we would be happy to have you come out and rent some cabins. We've got the two larger cabins, the Meyer cabin and the Gottschall cabin. Those will sleep about 20 people each, And then we have the Treat Cabin, which is just for two. It's a really nice little retreat cabin if you want to come out and just be either by yourself or with a partner and enjoy being in the cabin. And then we have a lot of what we call winter cabins that have electricity and heat. And so you can come out with your Boy Scout troop or your Girl Scout troop. They have 10 beds in there. And then we even have some what we call summer cabins that don't have heat or electricity. It might be getting a little late for those now, but we have lots of cabins you can rent. So you can check out our website at methodistcamp.org.
Okay, that's what I was wondering, is how do people get information on all these events? But methodistcamp.org is the place to go.
That's right.
Okay, that's cool. It sounds fantastic. It sounds like there's lots going on out there, always improving, always getting better, and you can volunteer.
Absolutely.
You can volunteer, and you can help out this weekend. It's the Chop-a-thon. It's this Saturday, October 11th, from 9 to 2 p.m. I don't think you have to be there the whole time.
Nope,
you can come,
nope,
show
you can
up,
come
and leave.
Whenever it works out for you, and we would just love to see you. And we're also planning to have Thanksgiving out at camp. So on Thanksgiving Day, if you don't have a place to go, this is a great community potluck event, and we have a big roaring fire, especially since we should have some wood by then. And we're also looking for board members that might want to join our board for managing the camp.
Okay. Do you guys have a Facebook page too?
Yeah, we do. I don't remember the Facebook page.
It's just, you just probably look it up, Eagle River United Methodist Camp. You'll find it there on Facebook. And, of course, it's mile 28 out the road, 27,500 Glacier Highway.
Yes, that is the place.
Yeah, it's great. Well, Jane Ginter, thank you so much for coming in and sharing with us today about camp.
Good. Well, thank you.
And the Chop-a-thon. I really appreciate you being here. Thanks so much.
I appreciate it, too. Thank you.
Kenneth Cheesh. That's going to do it for today's Juno Afternoon. Local stories, local events, local connection made possible by you via your donation and membership at ktoo.org. Gunnath Cheesh for listening. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Akbay 91.7. Hello, out the road. You can find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. You can also find live stream archives on our YouTube page, KTOO's YouTube. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from listeners and viewers like you. And Alaska Airlines Club 49, Hanson Gress, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunnath Cheesh, have a lovely Juno evening.